Today, let's think about learning.
Welcome to Coffee with Creamer, where you get to sit down with our host, Dr. Barry Creamer, for a conversation about faith, life, and culture. We'll look at old ideas through a new lens, turn those culture wars on their head, and paint a picture of the way things could be. If you like your thinking deep and your coffee hot, pull up a chair. You're in the right place.
I am involved in higher education. I have admired and appreciated higher education for a long time. From the time I was young, my parents had planned on me going to Baylor University, and I attended there. And then I got a master's degree at Criswell College in Dallas, where I now serve as president. And then I got a PhD at the University of Texas at Arlington. And I, although on the student side, did not always love being, I loved being in the classroom. It would be false to say I didn't love that. I loved being in the classroom. I didn't always love all the pressure of the assignments and the responsibilities and getting all those things done while you're also trying to live life. So there were challenges to it, I understood, but I valued it greatly. And I grew up in a context where there wasn't a lot of doubt about the value of higher education. There was some. I was around the people who looked askance at people who'd gotten too much education. You know, they'd lost their grounding in the real world, and they just weren't any good for anybody anymore. That kind of, I heard all of that, and we'll talk about some of that in a bit. But what I want to do is address some of these value questions about higher education that are emerging as downright cynicism in the current climate. The world we live in now is doing more than looking askance at higher education. It is definitely throwing stones at higher education, and in some cases, pulling what they see as the rug out from under the feet of higher education. And so I may be a little defensive. I don't mean for it to be defensive, but I sort of want to stand up and say there's a value to higher education, and let's talk about it for a minute, because things that I would have thought a while back didn't even need to be said out loud, apparently these days might need to be said out loud. So let's say them out loud. First of all, let me just justify why we need to talk about it for a moment. There is a current climate of cynicism regarding higher education. It's sort of hard to miss in the world around us right now. And it's not new. It's not new for different people to think, you know, at a variety of levels with fondness or doubt regarding higher education. One of the earliest works that I it automatically comes to mind for me is the Apology, Plato's Apology about Socrates. In other words, the defense that Socrates gives when he is accused of corrupting the youth of Athens. And it really is just an expression of a culture's cynicism, a society in that case's cynicism, of the value of higher education. Here Socrates is teaching philosophy, leading young people around, and giving them a very thorough and deep-seated education, understanding of the world around them. And the accusation against him is this. Socrates, I'll read it to you, is an evildoer. Socrates actually says, well, this is what they say about me. Socrates is an evildoer and a curious person. I mean, even just the opening lines, doesn't it make you go, is that a bad thing? Obviously, evildoer is a bad thing, but here's how they're justifying it. So he goes on. So Socrates is an evildoer and a curious person who searches into things under the earth and in heaven and he makes the worse appear the better cause, and he teaches the aforesaid doctrines to others. That is the nature of the accusation, Socrates goes on to say, and that is what you've seen yourselves in the comedies of Aristophanes, as he describes a play that was written about him that describes him this way. This is what you've seen yourselves in the comedy of Aristophanes, who has introduced a man whom he calls Socrates, going about and saying that he can walk in the air, and talking a deal of nonsense concerning matters of which I do not pretend to know either much or little. The point is, Socrates, who was accused by the citizens of Athens of corrupting the youth of Athens, and therefore who ought to give up his teaching or be put to death, which he, of course, he ends up choosing death over not living an examined life. He believes the unexamined life is not worth living. That's the famous expression everyone knows from Socrates about the subject. The point is that in accusing him, they were making a mockery of what he was doing with education because they saw it as, you know, having your feet in the air. He says he can walk in the air. That's what Aristophanes says. Obviously, in the comedy, in the comedic language that Aristophanes would use, he's using that metaphor. His feet aren't on the ground anymore. What he's teaching is useless, and it's undermining the nature of our religious beliefs and the traditions of our society, and so on. Even though, as Socrates points out, by the way, that he'd been doing this for a long time by the time they accused him of this, and many of the people who were accusing him of this and had their own doubts about his education were the people he had taught how to think. And so it was, there's a lot of irony built into the apology of Socrates. My point is that cynicism, a certain amount of doubt about the value of education at a fairly high level, is not new. People have always had this little shade of doubt about whether it's really worth what it costs and whether it produces more harm than good and whether people could find a different way to arrive at whatever benefits do come from it and all of that. It sort of makes sense. That antipathy toward education is also extended into today. And, you know, I will say to you, I think it takes two principal forms, and we'll talk about these two values in a minute. But the two principal forms are, first, that a liberal arts type of education, an education, say, in philosophy or literature or the things that we would associate with the liberal arts, not just science or engineering or something like that. I'm not demeaning those. We'll talk about those in a moment. But on the other side of the quadrangle, as people say, on the liberal arts side, people would say, oh, it's a waste of time, you know, and what we end up doing, because we say it's such a waste of time, is often reducing then the value of education away from liberal arts and toward, you know, workforce preparation. People need to learn how to get a job. I mean, and this is the joke that everyone makes, of course. Well, you get an English degree so that you can flip burgers at McDonald's. That's what you do. By the way, an unnecessary insult to the people who flip burgers at McDonald's. Anyway, moving on from that, the point is, that's the lamentation that Alan Bloom sort of gives in that famous work, I think it's the 1980s when he wrote it, The Closing of the American Mind by Alan Bloom. And, you know, I'm not an expert on the book. I haven't read it in a long time. But, you know, the overall thrust of the book is sort of a lamentation about having given up the great books tradition. Let's read Plato and let's read Machiavelli and let's read the great minds of the Enlightenment and so on. And we will build off of those the mindset that we need to maintain liberal democracy, for example. And that is a priority in Bloom's book. But anyway, the lamentation in the book is that we've given up our commitment to great books in favor of simple economic gain. And so the nature of that process is one that devalues what liberal arts education is all about, which is not just about whether you're going to make more money because of the education you're getting. Now, I understand why people would have that doubt or cynicism about liberal arts education. We'll talk more about it later in the discussion. But I mean, part of it is just, well, you're spending a bajillion dollars on an education now. I mean, college education is expensive. and then you're not going to make that money back? Why are you spending so much money? So I understand why people would say it, but that is the point of having the ability to say, you know, some things are not about the money. And therefore, that means sometimes you can't do them because you can't afford to do them. That's true, that it's not for everyone and not everyone has to justify paying it. I understand that. I understand those doubts that go along with a liberal arts education. But I also understand someone who can afford it or chooses to afford it being able to say, well, it's not about the money I'm going to get back from it. There is something more important than that. Which, by the way, would go along with every kind of charitable contribution you can imagine. Anyway, with all that said, the thing that made me think of things like this is I remember sitting in my driveway, pulling back out into the street, listening to the radio. I think I was listening to KRLD at the time or something, and they were talking about Scott Walker's moves as governor in Wisconsin at the time. In the budget. And what had happened is that I'll give you the language this way, that for over a century, the University of Wisconsin system had this guiding principle they called the Wisconsin idea. And the idea behind that was that the university's research and influence should improve the human condition generally and benefit every citizen of the state. And the ideas behind that, you know, improve the human condition, that kind of broad language is what is traditionally behind a lot of liberal arts education. We're trying to remember that we're human, that we're more than just machines in the economic system, but that even when we're functioning in the laboring nature of the economic system, there's still more to us. There's a part to the human condition that goes beyond that. Go back and listen to our episodes about Hannah Arendt's The Human Condition, and you can get some ideas about that as we talk about it. Anyway, in Wisconsin, the idea was that they would value the human condition benefits that come from that kind of education. And so the existing state statute at that time, this is back around 10 or 12 years ago, explicitly declared that basic to every purpose of the system, university system in Wisconsin, was the search for truth and a mission to extend knowledge and its application beyond the boundaries of its campuses. You know, that extending knowledge, searching for truth, all those kinds of ideas are very liberal artsy kinds of ideas. And what's funny is that when Scott Walker, the Republican, conservative Republican governor back then in Wisconsin, and he was just doing what he had said he was going to do all along, it's part of the values he was espousing at the time, that he proposed a budget, and in that budget, he quietly struck out those phrases from the state law. And in their place, he put language that only had to do with meeting the state's workforce needs. So, when you read that as just a person that's trying to pass a budget, you're not going to pay attention to it at all. Oh, they took out the mumbo jumbo about this and that, and they put in meeting workforce, you know, state workforce needs. I mean, that's what we need to do. We need people to graduate and be able to support the economy. So, okay, go ahead. But if you're in education and you see somebody take out, oh, we're trying to pursue the search for the truth, or, you know, the application of extending knowledge and its application beyond the boundaries of its campuses, you replace that with, you know, let's meet the state's workforce needs. It's pretty obvious what's going on. And it was to me, as well as it was to a lot of other people. And by the way, to their credit, to the citizens' credit back in the day and the other people who paid attention to it, he got a lot of pushback and they ended up putting that language back in. But they also ended up stripping $300 million from the University of Wisconsin system, a lot of it on the basis that they wanted to pressure things toward support of the state's workforce needs. That's the direction it went. And you know, if you're paying attention at all to the news today, that that's the direction the push is going in this very day. 10 years later, there is a heavy emphasis. This is going on in the current federal administration in the same way. You have to demonstrate the economic advantage that comes from people finishing your program, or your students can't qualify to apply to the federal government, to which they pay taxes, to go get the education they want to get if you can't demonstrate that it's actually providing that economic advantage to them. That kind of push is the same thing that was going on in Wisconsin 10 or 12 years ago. And all of that is a push against the idea that the liberal arts style of education, the idea of training people in broader thoughts and literature and the value of literature and in the deeper ways of thinking about the world and all that kind of stuff, it's just not worth it. And, you people want to do that, go join a monastery somewhere and you can study all you want. But if you want to be a part of the real world, you need to be a part of the workforce, you know, that kind of idea. I mean, a part of training the workforce is the idea. By the way, a lot of those quotations that I was just giving you come from the Washington Post, some Washington Post articles back in that day. It's around 2015 to 17. If I can find the exact link, I will give that to Daisy and she'll put it up as well. Anyway, you can tell the point is there is a second push that comes up against higher education, which isn't about liberal arts education at all. It's actually about the fact that that workforce preparation through higher education might just be a waste of time. I mean, why do you have to have all that infrastructure of a four-year education just so you can learn to go work in, you know, whatever field you're going to work in the economic system that doesn't require all the liberal arts and other requirements that higher ed pulls into it? You know, I attended, this has always just befuddled me, and it's just so contrary to what any decent person should do in a given context. When I say that, I'm talking about the speaker that I heard. So I went to a college graduation, a commencement ceremony a few years ago for some relative of mine. I care about the relative. I just don't want to identify the school, so I'm not going to say who it was. But I went to their graduation, commencement, and we got to celebrate them finishing their college education. It was fantastic. But while I was there attending that commencement, the speaker belittled throughout his speech, belittled the value of a college degree, using his own example of success without the college degree. And to be fair, it's on the college for having chosen somebody who would do that to give the commencement address. I mean, you're speaking to college graduates. Let's be respectful of the effort they just put into their college degree, even if you disagree with them. But the point is, this guy had had success without having to go get a four-year degree. In fact, he quit college and didn't focus on that at all and ended up being a great entrepreneur and creating some business and then becoming a significant donor to the school that he didn't think was all that valuable, apparently, which obviously isn't true. He viewed it as valuable, but the things that he was saying were undermining that value to the students who were graduating from the school. I'm making the point that we get a lot of that now. You don't have to go to school for 4 years to be a great computer programmer. You don't have to go to school for 4 years to be the smartest person in the, you know, whatever. And it's true that there are plenty of examples of people who have unbelievable, remarkable, profound success and influence in society without having gone to college. That has nothing to do with whether a college education has value for people or not. There is no way of going back and undoing what actually happened, so there's no way to create an apples for apples comparison. But who knows what that person would have accomplished with a college education? And I don't know. I don't know. Would it have been better? Would it have been worse? I have no idea. Nor do I know whether the college education for this person who he's saying, well, you may not need that for that career, actually is exactly what they need for their career. In fact, I will say we actually do know there's a value to that that is worth defending, which I'll come back to in a few minutes. The idea of criticizing, so here are the two things, just to give you a footing on where we are in the conversation right now. There are two things that people are cynical about. One is whether a liberal arts education has any real value or not. It's just so ethereal and feet in the air kind of thing. Why bother doing it? Look, go learn all that literature. Just go read a book. You don't have to go to college for that. That's one. And the other criticism is, well, let's say you do go to college because you want to make more money. Let's say you go to college because you want to learn the skills that would allow you to contribute to society better. Let's say you take it for one of those reasons. Well, in that context, there's a lot of accusation about the kind of education that college produces for the workforce being irrelevant. There are a lot of reasons for that argument being given. The basic sentiment is that things like tenure, you know, that a professor comes to the school and they teach for 40 years and they can just do whatever they want to do and they don't have to be responsive to the marketplace. The basic sentiment is that things like that, tenure and other rigid structures in education, sort of preclude the curricular changes or flexibility that would be necessary to keep up with the economy's changes and demands because of the lack of market feedback. That happens. It does happen. People do get an education, and partially just because of the four-year nature of the cycle of education. You get a freshman, 4 years later, they graduate. You know, you can have students signing up as freshmen and say, well, what do you want to take? Well, there's a shortage of nurses, so I'm going to go to nursing school. And in 4 years later, there may not be a shortage of nurses. And so you've gone through this whole process and realized you're being spit out into an economy that doesn't want to hire you. So because of things like that, there's always an argument about higher education creating a certain amount of irrelevant influence in the economic system. One of the prime examples of that right now is regarding AI, artificial intelligence. And there are a couple of different, completely different reasons for that. One is just the resistance to AI in higher education, which is palpable. I have probably less resistance to it than anyone else on my campus. But I understand their concerns are legitimate, by the way. There are huge problems that come with AI. Students can now just type the right prompt and they have a paper that's written for them and they can hand it in and they're done. And that's just one example. And students can do a lot more than that in order to sort of undermine the pedagogical process from the professor's side. But also, and you know, I understand why people fear this. This one doesn't bother me nearly as much. Obviously, we always have to address the problem of cheating in any school. Always, there's just a concern that, you know, the simpler way is sometimes just a cheap way out. And so you have to help students not fall for any of that enticement, right? But the other one, and this is along the same lines, but it's not cheating. The other one is that people don't like AI because it can create this sort of crutch for your mind that you become dependent on the ability to ask anything, anywhere, and get a full-blown response of any kind you want, including creating an image or whatever it is. And so that kind of mental dependency on devices or a mental dependency on Gemini or ChatGPT or whatever engine you use is scary to people. We want to make sure people can still continue using their minds. We'll talk more about that in just a moment. These are just on the problems side that we're talking about them right now, but also because it seems like it might make some instruction irrelevant. And this one, I just, you know, from the start, it's a little harder for me to defend because the reality is it's true. We don't teach as much logarithmic math. Now, I'm not talking about Criswell College. It's not like we were teaching logarithms to begin with. But, you know, we're not teaching as much logarithmic technique in math now that we have calculators, and way beyond calculators, now that everybody has a phone that's a computer that you can use as a calculator and that you can just type something into Google and get a mathematical response to it. It's true that we're not as good at doing the things we would have been able to do 100 years ago before TI started creating all the calculators. So anyway, my point is, I was being defensive there, but the point is, AI is going to do some of those same things. It is going to put at our fingertips through a machine some, not just bits of information, but some resources that we used to have to commit to memory. I mean, think about what AI would change for. And I don't do law. I haven't got a degree in law. I know quite a few lawyers. I enjoy talking law with people and stuff like that. So I don't know the exact terms for what I mean to say here. But I do mean this. Think of the difference for a lawyer trying to find exactly the right case in order to present some kind of precedent in a trial or some hearing that's going on. Think of the difference of being able to search for that with a law-informed AI engine instead of having to dig through volumes of, even on your own, even using Google, just trying to search through a Word document and figure out that you can find the right term. What AI can do with that is a whole lot easier, and it does seem to make some of the things we used to require as an outcome in formal education a little irrelevant. So I understand the problems that come from AI being introduced into a higher ed setting. But the potentials are also there, and not just in higher ed, but in general. Instead of thinking of it as, oh, well, now they can just, you know, type in a prompt and get a paper out, expect a book instead of a paper. All right, well, let's produce the book and then use all the resources it takes to evaluate that and see if it's any good. I'm not saying literally make that the requirement in class, but I am saying it's what all technology does. Because, and I've mentioned this in previous episodes, so I won't get bogged down here because I want to get back to how this influences our way of thinking about higher ed. But like with all technology, because the human desire to accomplish things is without bounds, it doesn't have an end. It doesn't have a cap on it. So because of that, our reach exceeds our grasp. The idea of AI is just like every other piece of technology. Now we can do more. Not now we don't have to do as much because we can get all that stuff we were doing before. We can get it done now quicker. And now we just have time off to go to the lake. That's not what people do. What they do when they can get more done is do more. And therefore, we accomplish more as people. So I just don't see that as big a disadvantage. It is a disadvantage, but it can also be a potential. It can improve our efficiencies. It can personalize content, all the things that we've benefited from with technology before. It can also make it impersonal. I know you can do a lot of other things with it too, but it also can free our focus to more than just rote memorization. It can replace some outdated instruction. We could replace with an AI resource. You know, hey, you need to do some remedial work in this area, go use this resource and it'll interactively work with you to bring it about. I mean, some of the AI interaction I have while I'm studying Spanish, which I'm still doing after 3 years or so working on that language, some of the AI interactions I have with it, I think are very helpful. And so I think there's a lot of potential in broadening the range of what we can aspire to, what we could accomplish, like I was mentioning a moment ago. Anyway, the point is, all of that creates this resistance to AI in higher education, partially because of the rigid structures people talk about. Well, you put that right next to this reality in our economy, that there is a huge demand for an AI-ready workforce. That demand is measurable. I mean, there is an overwhelming cry for more people, more engineers, more technical experts, for everything, for the back end, for the software development, for the application management, for all of the different things that are associated with that, for content experts who can then do quality control on AI output, for competence in AI prompting for any workplace. There's a demand for that. And how many, you know, in this environment where we're pushing back so hard against it, how many tenured professors do you think work at keeping up with how to build an effective AI prompt for legal research or for creating ethical dilemmas? And there are some. I'm not saying there are none, but I'm saying you would sort of think that wouldn't be the nature of the beast, and it's not, which means the whole development, this transformative economic and in some ways social development of AI's influence, whether you're resistant to it or not, doesn't change the fact that it's present and it's doing huge things. All you have to do is look at the number of AI data centers that are going up to realize what an influence this thing is having. To, you know, not to prepare for that in higher education would be a prime example of why people would accuse higher education in the workforce side of not being relevant or not keeping up with the way the economy goes. And so, you know, it's a challenge. The other criticism on the workforce side of higher ed, by the way, the other most significant criticism is just that there's a failure for it to demonstrate a meaningful ROI, a return on the investment. You know, the expense for higher ed is absurdly high. We don't have one of these at Criswell College, but, you know, a climbing wall that's taller than any other building in your city so that your kids can climb the wall and, you know, you can recruit better is expensive. And, you know, student centers along those lines are expensive. Building dormitories with swimming pools is expensive. And I'm giving examples that are real. You know, these things actually happen, not at Criswell College, but I'm saying they happen. And that and it's expensive for a reason, because that is how you recruit students, and you do get more students that way, and then you end up paying for it. So I'm not complaining about those schools, but I am making the point that by the time you graduate, you realize, man, I've spent not just a little bit of money. I've spent six figures, maybe significantly into the six figures, to get this education, and I don't know how long it's going to take me to get that back in comparison with what I would have been making otherwise. So the expense being so high makes it a little bit of a challenge. And then the fact that a lot of times students are doing that in a way that puts them into debt, sometimes reasonably, but sometimes, without necessarily thinking through the prospects of how they're going to pay off that debt. I'm not saying they don't receive counseling. I know all the requirements for it. Our financial aid department does all that stuff. We have an incredibly low debt ratio for our students that graduate, but we're not that expensive a school. And we work really hard to provide the financial aid that keeps our students from being in debt, partially because we're a school that's focused on people that want to give their lives and careers away to serving God. And that's not a good, that's not a good setting for saying, oh, we'll just go into huge debt and then you'll be able to pay that back on the wealth that's generated in self-sacrificing ministry. So we work really hard at avoiding that. Most schools don't. I'm not saying most schools don't care about it, but I'm saying there's a lot of student debt generated. And you can see why, if people are looking back at it after 15 years and they're still paying on their student debt, that they might look at higher ed and go, what is going on with this thing? I could have paid for two cars by now, and so on, or three or whatever it is. And that's all of this critique about the ROI is they've built up debt. They spent a bunch of money and they participated in an educational system that's not funded primarily by what they put into it. So you think about how expensive education is if students are going six figures into debt to pay their portion, and they're paying about a third of what it costs to receive their education, which is a pretty good approximation of what it's actually like. So, it's not surprising that the culture or society would look at that and go, man, that's a lot of money we're pouring down that hole. Are we getting anything back out of it? And I think because of the way we think about education, we might sometimes conclude that we're not. I just want to assert on the other side, I think we are, by the way. So just, this is not the point of these episodes. I will get to that point in the subsequent part of this conversation. But I do want to make a quick point to say before the end of this episode, it is worth it. There is a reason to do this. And it's just built into the way we think about higher ed. There's a reason people are still signing up for college right now, even in this cynical period of regarding higher ed with so much doubt. And the reason is because the values we know, I say that in tongue-in-cheek, maybe with air quotes, we know, we assume these values exist in higher education. First, that at least we used to think knowledge and truth are inherently good. We used to just think, I'm going to go get an education because it's important to know things. I'm going to go get an education because I want to have access to the truth. The expressions that we've used throughout history to make this point are not inconsequential. You shall know the truth and the truth shall set you free. Now, obviously, I know I love ministry and I've been a preacher for decades. That's a quotation from Jesus in the book of John. And he's talking about himself. You believe in me now. You're following me now. Then you're going to know the truth and the truth will set you free. And it matters, obviously, that it's about him, that he's making that point. But the generic truth behind it is still there. He's still saying, this is what's going to bring you to the truth, and that truth is what is going to set you free. In that context, he's making the point for them, he is the truth, and so in finding him, they're finding the thing that sets them free. But the generic truth still underlies all of that. It's the same thing with knowledge and power. I mean, we can attribute it to Thomas Hobbes or to John Locke, but the reality is the statement, knowledge is power, is a lot older than that. I mean, the way it's put in the Proverbs is this, in Proverbs 24, a wise man is full of strength. A man of knowledge enhances his might. For by wise guidance you can wage your war, and an abundance of counselors there is victory. In that first part, in verse 5, a wise man is full of strength. I mean, that's just knowledge is power. A man of knowledge enhances his might. Knowledge is power. But in the second part, it's making the point that you get that from instruction. That's what counselors are here. Someone who stands over you and says, yeah, you should think about this. You should incorporate this into your way of thinking about it. And that's how you find success. So the idea that truth and knowledge are inherently valuable, are inherently good, is worth holding on to. And that means there, it's not like I can go and pay a certain dollar amount and then have a certain amount of knowledge. Knowledge is not a commodity on which I can simply put a price. There is a value to it that exceeds what we would consider price. And so knowledge and wisdom and the ideas that go with the more liberal arts way of thinking about education is one side of the response that I would give to that and say, education is still worthwhile. But the other side's purely pragmatic. It's not my side. This isn't the side I normally argue. It's valid, though. I mean, this argument makes sense. And this is on the economic impact side of education. The economic impact on individuals and the economic impact on society is something we have always just assumed is going to be the case for a college education. You go to college, you learn more things because you learn more things and know more things. You can do more things, and therefore you're more valuable to the economy. So you want to make more money, go to college. We want our society to be better. Let's have a bunch of people that went to college. Let's measure ourselves against other societies by seeing if more of our students have more education. Then we'll know that we're doing a better job with our. That's how we've thought about higher education. And in this current cynical climate, we're kind of saying, yeah, I mean, I know that makes sense, but is it true? I don't really see it. I just think you could do fine without it. And in response to that, I would just say real quickly on both sides of this, it does make a difference. For individuals, let's put it in this context. I'll just use this illustration. For individuals, it increases earning capacity, and that's just all there is to it. Having a college education increases the likelihood that you're going to make not just a little more, but a lot more income in your lifetime. I'm not even at a school that focuses on this. This is not what we do. We train students for ministry. So this isn't self-defensive at all. But from this national whatever of educational statistics, National Center maybe of Educational Statistics, Daisy will create the link for you so that you can look it up yourself going to our website if you want to, comes this quote. For 25 to 34-year-olds, and by the way, you'll see they're choosing data from 2 or 3 years back because when you do good research, you get data that looks backwards. You have to look at things that you've been able to measure and verify. So here's a bit of data. For 25 to 34-year-olds who worked full-time, year-round, those who had higher educational attainment also had higher median earnings in 2022. For example, in 2022, the median earnings of those with a master's or higher degree, which was $80,200, were 20% higher than the earnings of those with a bachelor's degree, which was $66,600. It's true, it's 666, but don't go all revelation on me just because of that. Anyway, as their highest level of attainment in the same year, the median earnings of those with a bachelor's degree were 59% higher than the earnings of those who completed high school at $41,800 as their highest level of attainment. Now, I'm not all out for the money. I'm not trying to talk you into being about that, but I am saying if one of the arguments about higher ed right now is, well, I'm not sure it's worth it for the economic impact it has, then we're just not paying attention to the genuine statistics, because 60% higher earnings for people with a bachelor's degree than people who don't have a bachelor's degree is a reason to stop and say, you want to make more money, maybe you should go to college, right? That's not a bad idea. Higher education does have an inherent value. Now, I'm saying all of that, and I'm saying it on both sides. In the liberal arts side, it has a value because there's knowledge and truth to be had in studying and learning things. And on the economic side, it has a value, as can be demonstrated by the statistics in our own society. All of that's true. I do want to back up and say, especially on the liberal arts side, I recognize that there is a difference between the education industry, higher education in the way we talk about it, in America especially, the higher education industry, there is a difference between that and education generally. And so a person can say, well, I'm going to pursue all kinds of education. I'm just not going to do it in the structures of higher education. And there is legitimate criticism to be made there. It is possible for institutions to fail at instantiating the real value of education. You know what I mean? It's possible for institutions to bury their head in the sand and become irrelevant. That is true. It's possible for institutions or for certain professors to choose the history over what they themselves should have learned and not be able to provide for their students what an education ought to provide. That's true. But generally, the people, and this is absolutely true of the ones I know, the people I know from throughout higher education, they do equate the real value of education and the work that they do in the actual things they accomplish. That's what they're working on. They, to varying degrees, bring into the real world the ideals of higher education. And that's just incredibly valuable. And let me say on this note, I know there are plenty of people who want to say, I don't need to go to college in order to get my education. I'm going to read the books. I'm going to do the studying. And I respect that because I respect a free mind. Just go out and do your thing, right? Fantastic. But you know what's lacking in that? The discipline that's forced on you when someone else gives you a syllabus, when someone else hands you a deadline, when someone else asks a question about a part of a book that you didn't agree with or didn't think was interesting until they asked you that question that made you go, oh, that's why they had that huge section that I was going to skip over if I was just reading it for myself. The truth is, the disciplines that we study in are going to be disciplines that we're naturally attracted to. And a college education forces you to study things you would have ignored otherwise. And that's part of broadening our perspective and gaining more knowledge and truth so that we end up in a better place. There are some particular evidences of where the harms that are coming into our society because of the doubt that we have about higher education right now is starting to show up. That will probably be a topic for the next episode. But I want to pause here and just give you sort of a longer perspective on why I want to have this talk. It's not because I just want you to value higher education. I do want that. I do want people to value higher education. I want you to get why it's so important. It's not because I think every person has to go to college. I don't think that. I think the variety of people we have with the variety of skills that they have and the variety of gifts that God gives them are not measured in terms of this one being better because they went to college and that one not being as good because they didn't go to college. I don't believe that. I don't believe that about people. I don't think you're smarter just because you go to college. I don't believe any of that. I think our interests play a huge part in that, and then the nature of how we're going to serve in society plays a huge part of that, and our calling in life by God plays a huge role in that. All of that's hugely important. So I don't need to win a battle to say you have to have higher education or you just don't have a life. It's none of that. But what I don't want us to lose is what higher education, and then more particularly, and I haven't even gotten to this part yet, Christian higher education, and not just any Christian higher education, but I mean Christian higher education, and I will put a fine point on it here, like we do, meaning what Criswell College is particularly called to do in our mission, why that's so important. And we're not the only school that does it. Don't get me wrong. I'm not saying, oh, it has to be from our school. I'm just using us as a model, and it's the reason I'm attracted to this and called to doing this. Because we need someone speaking into our society, someone speaking into our culture, someone speaking into our churches and our denominations who's able to bring a message that we might not stumble across out in the general world. And that opportunity, that ability to be faithful in our obedience to what God wants us to be doing going forward is what this whole conversation is ultimately leading to. And again, I'm not trying to make sacred every hall of higher education or pretend that it's infallible and that its value is unassailable. No one should even ask a question. I'm not saying any of that. Everything about higher ed can be improved. Everything about Christian higher education can be improved as well. But there is a role for it that I want us to remember, and that's where we're going to be going in the next few conversations.
Thanks for joining us for Coffee with Creamer. Your cup of coffee may be finished, but we are not. Come back next week for a refill as we sit down to examine a new set of ideas and cultural issues. Don't miss an episode. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts or visit our website at barrycreamer.com. Until next time, keep your mug hot and your mind sharp.